Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295, but please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us Marty Schechter, and Marty is a supporter of Radio Liberty. He's known as the Soap Doctor, and he's the owner and founder of the Calben Soap Company that's been around since 1947. It's a family-owned, operated company making earth-friendly, triple-concentrate economical, all-natural, pure soaps for bathing, laundry, dishes, and hair. And without his background, let's go to Marty. Hi, Marty. How are you doing tonight?
Hi. Good evening, Dr. Stan. Thank you for inviting me again to your wonderful show.
All right, fine. Well, what can you tell us that would be of interest to our listeners about your soap and your soap products and why they should want to get them?
Well, I'd like to start off with some culture. I think the station, the show, could use a little culture. And it would only take a few minutes.
All right, you go right ahead.
Well, in the old days, you know, every story started out with once upon a time. But now our language has changed and it's updated. And now they say, you ain't going to believe this bull. But, you know, the story begins a mile high up in the mountains of Colorado, outskirts of Denver, is a castle. Residing in the castle are His Majesty King Bates, his gorgeous bride, Queen Bates, his lovely daughter, Princess Bates, and his teenage son, Master. It's Tuesday, and the king makes a proclamation. Today is wash day, and calls his adopted son, Hamlet, to go to Lord Albertson's to fetch detergents. Now, Hamlet doesn't always obey his stepfather. After all, he killed his father to marry his beautiful mother. There is what we call animosity. So he goes to his bedroom, gets upon a raised platform, and declares a soliloquy. Act 3, Scene 1, with apologies to William Shakespeare.
All right, fine. Well, of course, you are. I know that you feel that detergents don't do anywhere near as good a job as the products that you make.
True. But as Hamlet would say, to buy or not to buy, that is the question. Whether 'tis nobler in the home to suffer the perfumes and dyes of outrageous chemicals, or purchase pure soap against this sea of pollution, and by this acquisition, end them. To wash, to bathe much more, and by these real soap products, say we end the falsehoods and a thousand unnatural corruptions that detergent is heir to. 'Tis a consummation devoutly to be secured. To buy pure soap, perchance, to use? Aye, there's the suds, for in this pleasure of ownership, what dreams may come when we have cleansed our mortal home must give us pause. There's the respect that makes living of so long life enjoyable.
Now, we'll be back in just a moment with Marty Schechter. Okay, want to go ahead, Marty.
To buy pure soap, perchance to use. Aye, there's the suds, for in this pleasure of ownership, what dreams may come when we have cleansed our mortal home must give us pause. There's the respect that makes living of so long life enjoyable. For must we bear the unrelented distaste of enzymes, the antibacterials, the bathtub stench, the pangs of extreme costs, the sodium chlorides, the insolence of detergents, and the deodorants that patient merit of the unworthy takes, when he himself might his quietus make with an all-natural soap? Who would not bear this cost to grant and sweat under a life of perfumes, but that the dread of this could change forever with the undiscovered wealth of the Cal Bend Soap Company with a free catalog no consumer can be without? What puzzles the will is what makes us rather bear those expensive chemicals we buy. Dr. Stan must talk to all others that know not of him. Thus, ignorance does make cowards of us all, and thus the Cal Bend hue of resolution is strengthened over with great soaps, design, and enterprises of great quality and truth. With this regard, their sales of current turn upward and gain the name of action. Buy soap now. Oh, fair, oh, strong, Dr. Stan, nymph in thy orisons, be all my ads flow through thee. Thank you.
Well, Marty, can you give our listeners a real good reason why they would be better off buying your product than the traditional products that are available in the stores?
Well, there's more than that. There's the reason that you've got a product like Dove that says, we are the nutrition bar. Now, what does that mean? You have to eat it? I mean, it says it has vitamins A, B, C, D. But with all these vitamins, how much of each vitamin? What is the milligrams of the vitamin that's in there? It's as soon as you wash yourself down, you rinse it away, and it's gone. Reminds me of the egg shampoo story. A friend of mine started his own chemical company. He was going to
hold that stuff right there. No, we're just going to bring our other stations back on board here, and we'll. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Martin Schachter, from the Pure Bend Soap Company, and he was just telling us why, of course, he thinks that people would be interested in buying his soap. Would you like to go ahead and get that information out?
Yes.
Why would your soap be better than other soaps that are available on the market?
We make a natural, earth-friendly, pure soap. This is not a detergent. It doesn't contain any of detergent chemicals, like the antibacterials and the sodium chlorides and the perfumes and the dyes and all the additives. It doesn't contain that. It's pure. It's from a formula from the 18th and 19th century when soap was the predominant item in all the markets. And even during the 20th century, halfway up to 1950, when soaps were predominant, but then they disappeared and detergents became the predominant cleanser everywhere and anywhere in all the markets and discount houses and supermarkets and pharmacies.
Well, Marty, explain to me, what's the difference between a soap and a detergent?
Soaps are made from vegetable oils, coconut oils, without perfumes, dyes, or additives. Detergents are made from waste petroleum, saponified together into a gooey mess. And in order to make that mess work, they have to bleach it because it's a dark, gummy mess. They have to add perfume to it because it has a terrible stench. They have to add salt to it to make it free-flowing because it will not pour out of the box. And you use it not by the teaspoon, but by the cupful. And detergents are stronger than dirt. They clean too well. Unfortunately, in their cleansing ability, they microscopically break down the fibers of the cloth. That's what lint is. Lint is broken clothing. The soaps dissolve the soil, melt the soil, rinse it away, don't harm the fabrics whatsoever, eliminates broken clothing. That's what happened to hand-me-downs. They disappeared. Detergents took care of that. So there is a big difference. Soaps are economical. Detergents are expensive. Soap is all natural. Soap is earth-friendly. Detergents are not. They pollute. They burn. They hurt. They rust. You can't even compare the differences. This is why up to the 20th century, 1950, soaps were the only items available, and then they disappeared because detergents were cheaper to make, and all the major chemical manufacturers grabbed onto that to make more profit. Not to help the consumer, not to do better cleaning, but for profit, unfortunately.
All right, fine. Well, as far as the soaps are concerned, then how much soap do you actually have to put in, say, for a load of washing?
Well, we supply a little tiny measuring scoop to do a wash load. The measuring scoop, if you fill it up with water, it measures out at 1 ounce. If you fill it up with soap, it measures out as 3/4 of an ounce. So if you use one scoop, which is 3/4 of an ounce, for an average load, it does a fine, all-natural, clean job. If you have an extra soiled load, if you have a greasy load, an extra big load, it may require 2 little scoops, which will come out technically to 1.5 ounces. Now, you can't do that with detergents. And also, you want to use hot water. Hot water cleans better, kills bacteria better. I mean, you can't wash a load of dirty diapers in cold water.
Now, why do they keep stressing that they want to have these detergents that will wash in cold water? What's the supposed advantage of that, that you can wash in cold water?
Well, it's funny you say that, because Tide, 4 weeks ago, came out with a full-page ad in the Wall Street Journal that they have a new product called Tide Cold Water.
Now, what's the advantage of cold water? Why would anybody want to, unless, you know, they're in a place without a hot water heater?
There's only one advantage, and that is when you wash woolen sweaters, woolen blankets, woolen clothing, cold water prevents shrinkage. But it has no other advantage than that hot water cleans better, rinses better, kills the germs. And you've got laundries that get the hot water up to 180 degrees to do a fantastic cleaning job. It's important. I recommend to all consumers to go to their water heater and turn it up. The hotter the water, the better the cleansing, the better the disinfecting, and it works. Big difference.
All right, fine. Well, of course, these are things a lot of people just don't think about. Certainly, I don't think about it. And fortunately, my wife does all the washing, and I don't have to worry about it. She does a great job.
I'm sure she uses hot water.
I'm sure she does. Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the other products that you offer. You have a bar soap. You have the soap that for laundry. What else do you offer?
We only make 4 basic soap items that'll do 200 jobs: a bath soap bar, a liquid cream pure soap for pots, pans, utensils, wash the car, mop the floor, do the windows, a hair soap, which we call shampoo. Shampoo is a generic word, an old 2,000-year-old Hindu word. Shampoo means to massage. So we call it by its generic name, shampoo. It's a triple concentrated cocoa butter shampoo, completely neutral, no alkali, no acid, none of the additives from all the major shampoos in the marketplace on the shelf. They contain anywhere from 24 to 36 chemicals in it. Why? I don't know. And they all say, keep out of the reach of children. Don't children shampoo their hair? You know, this is what we're talking about. So the shampoo is thick as molasses, highly concentrated, very sudsy, a rich, thick foam. We make a laundry soap powder. Now, if people say, well, I'd really rather have a liquid soap or liquid laundry cleaner, you could take 16 ounces of our laundry powder, mix it in with a gallon of hot water. I say hot so it dissolves faster. You got a gallon of liquid laundry. You use a tiny amount to do the job. It doesn't deteriorate the clothing. Now, mind you, used clothing, they're already halfway gone. It's not going to stop that. But on new sheets, new towels, new clothing, it'll keep it and give it longevity. You will have hand-me-downs. You don't now. And then we make a liquid dish soap, which is a cream. It's for pots, pans, utensils. It's all-purpose. You can take 1 ounce of that, mix it in with a gallon of water, and you got a gallon of all-purpose cleaner for pennies. You can wash the windows, mop the floors, clean the car, shampoo and wash the car down. It's all purpose. We include data bulletins or instruction sheets for every product with our goods and our merchandise so the consumer can understand that they can eliminate hundreds of chemicals that they're buying, paying a fortune for it, don't have to. They need economy, they need savings, they need earth friendliness, they need purity of products that will do the job twice as good as what they're buying now, triple concentrated without the fillers or the inert ingredients and the waste that most of the products have right now.
All right, well, how can people reach you? How can they get more information?
Very, very easy. We have a free catalog. We have a toll-free number, 1-800-340-7091. That's 800-340-7091. They can see us on the web. We got a beautiful, beautiful website. That's www.calbenpuresoap.com. That's CalbenPureSoap.com. One word, CalbenPureSoap.com. Everything's on there, our data bulletins, beautiful color photographs of our Pure Soap products, descriptions, costs, order forms, everything is on there. If you want something right away, you can look it up anytime. You can phone us for a free catalog, write us, fax us. We don't care. We're all family here. We'll take care of you. We'll guarantee everything 100% to your 100% satisfaction.
Well, now, what about the products sold in the stores at all?
Well, we decided when we... originally, when we were making all these products, we only sold commercial enterprises like hospitals and schools and healthcare professionals. It's only a couple of years ago that the light bulb went on and said, wait a while, there are more families out there, more consumers out there, more people out there than there are doctors and hospitals and schools. So we decided to work a factory direct program to the consumer, saving them a small fortune. There's no markup, no salesperson, no anything. It's direct wholesale to the consumer of our Pure Soap products. Factory direct, toll-free number, website, free catalog, sampler packages of all our products that you can get a sampler. It's like a Whitman sampler of bath soap, hair soap, dish soap, laundry soap. We've got, for bulk buyers, we've got a 1 year, a 3 year, a 4 year, a 5 year supply that really will save, guaranteed, tax-free, over $1,000 a year in cash savings by just getting rid of all those detergents and getting back to good old-fashioned soap. Real soap.
And, of course, certainly the technique of making soap has been around for a long, long time. We seem to be getting away from that more and more with all these fancy things progressing. But, of course, are the new progressions, are these new products really any better than the old-fashioned one? And so you actually are selling the old-fashioned bar soap. And of course, is there anything there? Do you have any additives to it at all?
Any what?
Any additives at all?
Yes, a longevity, number one. We're 58 years old. We're all family. We're a family partnership. We're not a corporation. We have thousands of customers, families, coast to coast, that have been getting our products for decades, and we finally have computerized them, so we know what we're talking about. We haven't done that. We've been so old-fashioned and so conservative and so stubborn, we stayed away from computers. But in 2003, we set up and computerized all our accounts, so we have their phone number and name. We do not give anyone's name, address, phone number, credit card to anybody. We don't believe in that. We feel you get enough junk mail as it is, and we do not share with nobody. Once your name becomes in our computer and our file, it's safe there, it stays there. We don't tell nobody.
Okay, just hold that thought for just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Marty Sector. We're just talking about his Calvan soap that, of course, he has a product, and he's marketed primarily, and we know that through radio programs and through other forms of marketing, and he certainly, we hear his advertisements on several of the other major networks we do. As you know, we do the American Freedom Network first thing in the morning, and then we do the Zenison Network in the afternoon, and of course we've known of their products for a long time, but only recently had an opportunity to talk to Marty personally, and of course he was gracious enough to send us one of the trial sampler of that with all the products there, really beautifully packaged and very nicely laid out. And of course, one of my best friends is trying them out to see how they work. I'm looking forward to getting his report. But you must have a pretty good product. You wouldn't be able to stay on the market for 47 years.
Exactly. It's basically, once they get the product, they'll keep buying it again and again and again in a reorder or aftermarket fashion. With our guarantee, with our quality, with our low costs, you can't miss. Everybody goes to the supermarket. They all buy so-called laundry soap and bath soap and hair soap. These are not soaps. They are detergents. They're synthetic. They're artificial. They're toxic. They're hazardous. They got poison labels on it. It don't take much. To, you know, give you an example, Procter & Gamble has just started a new campaign. This is 2 weeks ago. I got a big article in the Wall Street Journal. Procter & Gamble wants to use their old image of the Crest Kid. And they will have their new commercial coming out. Look, Mom, no cavities. Remember that in 1950? Well, I'd like to change that and say, look, Mom, no poison. Because the toothpaste is poisonous if you swallow it. It says so right on the box. Right on the tube, it says, and I'll read it to you because I got it in my hand here, warnings. Keep out of reach of children under 6 years of age. If more than used for brushing is accidentally swallowed, get medical help or contact a poison control center right away.
Well, of course, that is because these are fluoridated toothpaste, and the fluoride is certainly a very, very poisonous substance. The reason, of course, the reason that they put the fluoride in is because it kills the bacteria, and of course, you always wonder if it'll kill the bacteria. What else will it kill? But the thing is, cavities come because the bacteria break down carbohydrates, create an acid, and the acid then tends to erode the teeth. And of course, what the advantage of these fluoridated toothpaste is they really do seem to cut down on cavities. I don't know that it's necessarily very good for you to have that poison, but they certainly seem to have cut down a great deal on cavities over this last 30 or 40 years.
Unless you swallow it.
Oh, you never want to swallow that.
Well, let me tell you what they're doing. They come up with four, and this is a full-page ad in all the current magazines, the up-to-date magazines. One flavor is Cinnamon Rush. Then they got Extreme Herbal Mint. They got Fresh Citrus Breeze and Refreshing Vanilla Mint. Now, these are flavors. You take a 4-year-old, a 5-year-old, a 6-year-old, you give him a cookie, he's going to chew on it and swallow it. You give him ice cream, it's going to melt in his mouth, he's going to swallow it. Now, we get something so good tasting, like toothpaste, he's not learning enough to spit it out, he's going to swallow it.
Hold that thought there for just a moment and we'll be... Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Marty Sector. He's talking about his various soap products. And, Marty, let's get that telephone number out one more time. And, of course, the Internet site.
The website. The number is toll-free. It's 800-340-7091.
And the website again.
The website is calvenpuresoap.com.
Okay.
All one word, Cal, C-A-L, Ben, B-E-N, PureSoap.com. On the web, call us, we'll mail you a free catalog, we'll introduce you to our sampler pack, the one I sent to Dr. Stan, we'll introduce you to tremendous cash, tax-free savings with the price of gas going up and the price of utilities and everything, energy. let's save some money now. Let's take you out of coach and put you into first class. That's what we want to do.
All right, fine. So now what message would you like to leave with our listeners this evening, and why should they really contact you, give you a call there?
Well, one, they'll be so completely flabbergasted that products of this quality are available factory direct at wholesale prices. When they use the products, they will absolutely flip their lid, because the differences between what they've been using and what they'll be receiving is a world of difference. Can't be compared. They will not only use the products, they not only will like the products, they will love it. We create love affairs with every family, individual, or person in the United States. These are American-made products, nothing imported. Everything is American-made here in California. And we just love to hear from you. We'll answer any question on any cleaning problem. We'll tell you any answer on any cleaning products that you're aware of. We're information. We don't just want to sell. We want to educate. With education, you go forward, and that's what we'll do for you.
All right, fine. Well, I really appreciate so much you taking the time to be with us this evening. Do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners?
Yes, I'd like to close with a poem.
Go right ahead.
A bee's a busy little soul. He has no time for birth control. That is why, in times like these, we have so many sons of bees.
All right, fine. Well, thank you very much, Marty. That's appreciate you being willing to come on with us this evening.
Thank you, Dr. Stan. Looking forward to talking to you next month.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Good night.
All right, well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and of course, that was Marty Sachter. And this evening, the rest of the evening, we're going to have just open lines, and we'll be talking about really whatever you'd like to talk about. If you'd like to talk about the new pope, because one of the things I'm really so concerned about is the issue of fluoridated water. And of course, to most people, that is simply a side issue. Why, of course, anybody worried about fluoridated water really doesn't understand the tremendous job that water fluoridation has done. Well, I would like to suggest, ladies and gentlemen, I've been reading, in fact, I've read through now for the second time, Chris Bryson's excellent book, The Fluoride Deception. And I hope that everyone in the listening audience will give serious consideration to getting that book. And, of course, we're putting together a talk. We're going to be going down in the Los Angeles area on the 4th of May, just about 2.5-3 weeks from now. And I'm trying to put together something that will make people really understand that this is an issue that affects every individual in our country. Because what happened, of course, one of the most deadly poisons known to mankind is fluoride. The fluoride atom is certainly up at the upper left-hand side of the periodic table. It is a very unstable atom. The fluorine gas will actually melt through steel. And, of course, the fluoride compounds, they'll etch glass. There's no other way to etch glass as this well, or you can actually etch ceramics with this. And you do because the fluoride, it snatches on because it has a very powerful center of protons. I think there are 4 protons there. And just a few little electrons on the outside will grab every other chemical compound. This is one of the most deadly compounds known to mankind. And, of course, it has been used in almost every chemical process. It's used in smelters. It's used in flux. And if you go down the list, I mean, if you're going to smelt aluminum or beryllium or cadmium or magnesium or nickel or zinc or iron or lead or silver or gold, you have to have fluoride. You can't enrich uranium without fluoride. You use fluoride in the sarin gas. You use it in freon gas. You use fluoride in certainly in so many compounds, and they have a profound impact on the mind and on the brain. But the average individual doesn't understand that. That's the active ingredient in Prozac and Zoloft and Luvax, I think is the title of it. So what are we doing with this product? Why, we are putting it in the drinking water all across America. 67% of the drinking water in America is fluoridated today. Is it safe? Well, we'll talk about that when we get back to it in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, we're going to have open lines this next hour. So we hope many of you will seriously consider going ahead and giving us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But, you know, 50 years ago, when they began, actually it was 60 years ago, it was 1945, when they started the first fluoridation experiment here in the United States. And this was done in a place called Newburgh, New York, with Kingsington, New York, as the control town. Now, why did they want to fluoridate the water? Were they interested in actually helping children to have better teeth? No, actually, the scientific studies that had been done with animals when they fed them fluoride showed that the teeth actually got more brittle, and there really was no significant decrease in cavities, but they had to sell the American people on a lie. Basically, fluoride is absolutely essential to the whole industrial process in the United States. So if America was going to be a great industrial nation, we had to have our industry be able to use fluoride and fluoride products without any restriction or consideration for their industrial hazard. And as we've seen, of course, what's happened with asbestos and all the lawsuits that actually came secondary to asbestos. Why, first of all, it bankrupted many of our major corporations, and secondly, we've had to give up asbestos being used because it was just too dangerous. However, fluorides are the foundation of an industrialized society, and whether it be Teflon or Scotchgard, whether it be Cipro, the antibiotic that they use now, of course you have to be careful when you use it. Why? Because your tendons tend to rupture when you're taking Cipro. In fact, that's why immediately after the 911 attack, and of course Dick Cheney had to know that the anthrax attack was coming because he and his entire staff went on Cipro. But, of course, she couldn't play racquetball for at least 6 weeks because he'd been on Cipro. Why? Because there's a fluoride compound in Cipro, and it breaks down the enzymes of the body and tends to break down much of the connective tissue structure of the body if you take it in significant quantities. And if you had a product like this, how would you be able to sell the American people that, you know, you should be able to use this and use it readily? And this is one of the greatest scams that has ever been perpetrated. If America is going to be an industrial country, we had to have free use of fluoride. And if we wanted to be a nuclear power, we had to have free use of fluoride because it's essential to actually enriching uranium. And we'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we hope that maybe if you're out there and you'd like to give us a call, you have something you'd like to talk about, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And, of course, we're preparing a talk. We're going to give it on the 4th of May down in Los Angeles, actually in Orange County, to the Freedom Forum there, and we hope that if you live in that area, you'll want to come. But we're going to give you the history of actually the greatest scam that has ever been perpetrated in these civilized people. And they were able to take a poison, which is fluoride, and turn it into a panacea. They were able to take an industrial pollutant and turn it into the promise of beautiful teeth with a perpetual smile. They were going to change the perception of the problem. And this was really a very, very real problem because in areas where they used fluoride excessively, and of course DuPont was doing this during the Second World War, enriching uranium, and fluoride is the key to that. And of course, as they would vent the fluoride up into the air, why, of course, the farmland adjacent to that would get contaminated, the animals would die. They actually had a big plant in New Jersey. And the peach trees all around there died. And, of course, the farmers during the Second World War, this would be 1943, 1944, when they were working on the atom bomb, didn't want to bring lawsuits against DuPont. But immediately after the war, they did bring large lawsuits against DuPont. So how were they going to, of course, to convince the American people that there was no basis for industrial claims, first of all, for venting this hazardous material into the air, which would destroy the surrounding countryside. You'd destroy the trees, you'd destroy the bushes, and the plants. I mean, you couldn't plant certain vegetables and things in the soil, and soil that before would grow things now would no longer grow things or grow them well at all. And then the people adjacent to the nuclear power plants, the plants that were actually vetting large amounts of fluoride, they developed emphysema. They developed fluorosis. And, of course, you could look at their teeth and you'd see the white, blotchy splotches on their teeth, and that's a sign of fluorosis. And, of course, it would attack the bone. It would attack the endocrine system in the bodies. It would attack the mentality of the individual and the fertility of the individual, but they couldn't let the public know this. And so how are you going to be able to come up with a program to convince the American people that fluorides were not something you had to be concerned about? Well, they came out with a Clean Air Act. And the Clean Air Act talked about the dangers of sulfur dioxide. They talked about the dangers of soot. It talked about the dangers of ozone. It talked about, later on, about the dangers of mercury. But it never mentioned the danger of fluoride. Now, how are you going to sell this to the people? Well, the Atomic Energy Commission worked very, very closely with the U.S. Public Health Service, and they came up with a clever, clever scheme. Why don't we convince the people, the American people, that fluoride is necessary for health? It's necessary for the health of children's teeth. In fact, people need fluoride in their diet to develop normally. Now, there was absolutely no scientific basis for this. In fact, all the scientific studies showed the toxicity of fluoride. But they couldn't let the American people know that. So what they did, of course, immediately after the end of the Second World War, America went into full military production. We were going to be the mightiest military nation in the world. We were going to have more atom bombs than anybody else, but you couldn't have atom bombs unless you enriched the uranium. And you couldn't enrich uranium unless you could use large amounts of fluoride, because fluoride is the key to enriching uranium. So the Atomic Energy Commission hired a man named Harold Hodge, Harold Carpenter Hodge. And Harold Hodge was closely aligned with the Rockefeller Foundation. He was a professor at the University of Rochester. He was the head of the National Academy of Science Division of Toxicology. He was the first president of the American Society for Toxicology. He was also aligned with the Central Intelligence Agency that wanted to do experiments on how you could use chemicals to control the mind of people. And he was also aligned with the fluoride industry, at least with the great corporations who were using fluoride. And Harold Hodge announced to the American people that you had to have fluoride to be healthy. No scientific basis for it at all. He said, certainly there was possibility of, after prolonged ingestion of fluoride, you might have some problems. He gave a figure, you could ingest fluoride from 20 to 40 milligrams a day, and maybe after 20 years you might have some toxicity. What was the scientific basis for his statement? Absolutely none. There was no scientific basis for it. Many years later, why he decreased the amount of fluoride that you'd have to eat to get toxicity to 10 milligrams a day. Well, what happened was, because fluoride is present in everything today. I mean, it is present in your Wheaties. It's present in your post-toasties. It's present in your food. It's present in anything that, of course, it is sprayed, because since we've outlawed DDT, now they use fluoride, tremendous amounts of it. Plants are too smart, far smarter than human beings. They will not absorb fluoride through the roots. I mean, you don't get fluoride into vegetables. So we spray it on the outside in the name of pesticides, and you get terribly toxic doses of fluoride in the, almost anything that you eat, like lettuce, and certainly any of the things that are grown in the ground where there's fluoride is used as sprays. Fluorides are used actually to spray many of the grapes and many of the fruits that we eat, and there's a fluoride residue on the outside. And fluoride, of course, is a deadly poison. I mean, we use it as an insecticide. It kills the insects, on the vegetables and on the various types of fruit that we spray it on. It works in the mouth as a when they put it in toothpaste because it kills the bacteria in the mouth. Now, how does it do that? Well, it attacks the enzymes of the bacteria. And, of course, we have better dentition today than we ever had before, mainly because when you use fluoridated toothpaste, it kills the bacteria in your mouth. That's the only reason that it really works. It kills the bacteria in your mouth. And, of course, bacteria break down carbohydrates, create an acid, and the acid actually erodes the enamel of your teeth. That's how fluorides work today. In fact, American Dental Association, the Center for Disease Control, have said ingestion of fluoride does no good. And we have their statement. Now, they will say, oh, yes, it's going to act locally. And so, actually, if you have water in your mouth that has fluoride in it, somehow you're going to get that fluoride picked up by the teeth. There's no actual evidence of that. But, of course, by saying it often enough, why they've convinced the people that's pretty worthwhile as they continue poisoning the American people. It was back in 1995 when the American Dental Association and, of course, the American Academy of Pediatrics and the CDC recognized that we were poisoning our children. And so they actually came out. This was 1995, 50 years after water fluoridation first began in the United States. And they said that no child less than 6 months of age should be given any of fluoride drops. Whether they were in an area where the water is fluoridated or not, they should have no contact with any fluoride product. They were not to get any vitamins with fluoride in them. They were not to get any fluoride drops. Now, for 50 years, we gave fluoride drops to every infant. We gave it to pregnant women. And, of course, we insisted that as soon as a child could eat vitamins, they got vitamins with fluoride in it. Actually, the new recommendations that are coming out now basically say that till a child is 3 years of age, there should be very definite restriction of fluoride. Why? Because it's in everything the child eats. It's in the water they drink. It's in the formulas that they drink. It's in the baby food that they eat. If they have any fruits or vegetables, they're getting toxic doses of fluoride there. And actually, 67% of the children in America today have one or two teeth that have evidence of dental fluorosis, which is actually a sign of fluoride toxicity. But they cannot tell the American people that. They have poisoned a whole generation of our children. If you look and see what's happening in America over the last 50 years, I will tell you one thing, and that is that the dental health of this country is much better than it was 50 years ago. And our children have far fewer cavities. But they have no less cavities in areas that are not fluoridated than in areas that are fluoridated. And if you look at the study out of Newburgh, New York, 50 years after fluoridation was started there and compare it with Kingston, New York, which did not fluoridate their water 50 years ago, there's absolutely no significant difference in the rate of cavities in children. Absolutely no difference at all. The only trouble is that Newburgh, New York, has twice the incidence, almost twice the incidence, of heart attack and sudden death from cardiac disease as Newburgh, New York. And the same thing holds true for Grand Rapids, Michigan, that began fluoridating back in 1945. They have twice the rate of cardiac death that you will find throughout the rest of the country. We find cancer on the increase all throughout America. We find emphysema on the increase throughout America. We find certainly that 1 in 6 American children has some sort of a neurodevelopmental abnormality that would be autism, attention deficit disorders, attention deficit hyperactivity disorders, cognitive disorders. Our kids are just not very smart. And you take the children who graduate from American high schools and you compare the scholastic tests to that of children who are, say, in Europe, where they will not allow them to fluoridate the water there because they've gotten the truth about what this is really all about and they don't want to be part of this grand experiment. And our high school graduates cannot compete scholastically with the graduates of children from other countries. Now, everybody will tell you, oh, well, that's because our schools are so bad. Well, that certainly is part of it. But there is another element that nobody wants to talk about. And that is that there have been a large number of studies, at least six of them, that show that if you drink fluoridated water, we will knock up to 10 points off your IQ. And these studies are readily available. Scientists who work for the Environmental Protection Agency back in Washington, D.C., have been trying to get this information out to the American people, and it is totally blocked out by the controlled media that is going along with this massive propaganda campaign to convince the American people fluoridation is good and fluoridation is not good. Fluoride is an industrial poison. It is used as a pesticide. It's used as an insecticide. And the average American has never asked, well, if you can use it as a rat poison, why would you want to be putting this into the drinking water? As Dr. Hersey, who is a scientist who works with the division that deals with drinking water at the EPA, talks about what they're putting in the drinking water. Now, you probably think they're putting sodium fluoride in the drinking water. They're not. They're putting fluosilicic acid or flusilicic acid into the drinking water. And where do they get this? Why, they get it. 90% of the fluoride that is put in drinking water in America comes from the scrubbings, from the smokestacks, where they do the smelting and the various other industrial places, primarily the phosphate industry, where they, of course, they cannot put this material out into the air, so it has to be taken out by scrubbers and the smokestacks. And then what are you going to do with this terrible material? Why, you can't vent it in the air because it's too toxic. You can't put it into the rivers because it is too toxic. You can't put it into a lake because it's too toxic. You can't simply bury it in the ground because it's too toxic. So we put it into the drinking water. Does that make sense to you? Well, ladies and gentlemen, we hope that you'll want to get the book, The Fluoride Deception, and our syllabus and our video when we have it out. And we'll give you all the answers to all the questions. And you'll find one of the greatest and most dangerous scams ever perpetrated on the American people. We've got Larry calling from Salinas. Hi, Larry. How are you doing?
Fine.
Do you have a question or comment?
Well, I was just wondering if you'd heard about that other substance that takes like 50 IQ points off.
What are you talking about?
Catholicism.
Oh, I see. Well, this is not Larry. This is John.
And they don't want to know anything, do they? They just want to stay stupid.
All right, fine. Anything else you want to say? Well, that was Larry. This was John. And John believes that all the problems of the world are referable to the Jesuits. And, you know, he feels that the Jesuits are responsible for really this whole satanic conspiracy that's undermining our society. Basically, he read a book. It was called The Vatican Assassins by Eric I think it's Eric Phelps wrote it. I wouldn't swear to that. And I've interviewed the author of the book. And a lot of interesting information there. But the Jesuits are the Pope or the Catholics are not any more responsible for all of our problems than the Jews are, or the Protestants, or the Masons, or the Skull and Bones. Now, they're in, all of these organizations are involved. But we're dealing with the Luciferian movement that is intent upon, first of all, destroying Christian civilization. But in the process of that, they are really interested in destroying humankind. And what everybody has really, of course, missed, as we discussed, water fluoridation, is water fluoridation is being used for population control. And we have articles out of the Safe Planning Perspective put out by the Guttmacher Institute, where they talk about how if we want to control the population, we've got to put something into the water. We have articles out of something called Man and His Future, SIBA Symposium back in 1962, when Francis Crick, who along with Watson actually determined the structure of the DNA helix, he's talking about how we've got to put something in the water to control the population. You go back and you can read Bertrand Russell's book, The Impact of Science on Society. He talks about how the use of diet, injection, injunctions, we're going to be able to mold the character of the people of society. And elsewhere, he talks about the importance of population control. If we could just have a black plague that sweep the world once every generation, why, there wouldn't be any problem. So if you understand that they long ago decided if they could just put something into the water, why they could control the population. Studies on fluoride, and of course you can get it out of Fluoride Magazine, and this will all be in the syllabus, they lower the testosterone level, they lower the motility of the sperm. If you compare fluoridated regions, cities with non-fluoridated, you have lower fertility rates. We know, of course, this attacks the endocrine system of the woman, because girls go through the menarche much earlier in areas with fluoridated water. If these things are true, why don't you ever hear about them? Why, very, very simply. Because there are five mega corporations that dominate the American media. If you haven't read Professor Ben Bogdakian's book, The New Media Monopoly, you need to get it. We do carry that book. And you need to understand that they're poisoning our people all across America, and we've got to put a stop to it. And once people understand what's happening, I think they'll join us. Well, this is Dr. Stan. If you'd like to give us a call, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. We've got a great program coming up this next hour. We've been talking about the problems with water fluoridation. Actually, of course, the studies have shown an increase of cancer in areas where the water is fluoridated. Dr. Yamianis did the studies on that, along with Dr. Dean Burke, who was chief of chemotherapy research at the NCI. And, of course, they were both, of course, attacked by the major media, demonized and radicalized. Anybody who thought there was anything wrong with fluoride was some sort of a radical. And this was really all coordinated by a man named Edward Bernays. Edward Bernays had written a book called Propaganda. He was Sigmund Freud's nephew. He was actually under contract to the National Institute of Dental Research, which is part of NIH, to use propaganda techniques to sell the American people on water fluoridation. Dr. Bernays, Edward Bernays, also was able to convince women that they should smoke. In fact, he was actually under contract to the cigarette companies to put out a propaganda campaign to get women to begin smoking, and millions of women began smoking, and millions of women have died as a result of the propaganda campaign that Edward Bernays put forward. And this is all covered, of course, in this wonderful book on the fluoride deception. You need to get that. You need to understand. Harold Hodge, who, of course, was coordinating this whole program for the Atomic Energy Commission, trying to convince the American people how wonderful fluoridation was. Harold Hodge was the one who coordinated the experiments where they would inject plutonium and uranium into the children who were orphans in orphanages, or mentally defective children, or unsuspecting patients. Harold Hodge was truly a monster. Harold Hodge, of course, the dean of toxicologists in America, had no concern at all for human life. He knew, of course, that fluoride had a toxic effect on the brain. And yet he recommended it and assured people all across America that there was absolutely nothing to worry about. He gave the levels of where you could actually ingest fluoride without any concern, without any scientific background at all. But because he was a professor, because he was the chairman of the National Academy of Science of a Division of Toxicology, and the first president of the American Society for Toxicology, everybody thought he was telling the truth. And the great tragedy is, of course, that he wasn't. He was lying to the American people, and millions of people have died because of Harold Hodge and Bernays. Well, this is Dr. Stan. We've got Greg calling from Indiana. Hi, Greg. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, Dr. Stan. It's a pleasure to talk to you. I have never called you before. I've been listening to you for probably 3 to 4 years. Normally, I am at work. I work on the evening hours, so I have a C-band satellite, so I just plug you into my computer on the hard drive and put you on an MP3, and then I download you and play you at a time when I can listen to you.
Well, I'm glad you're listening out there. Do you have a question or comment on what we're doing?
I really like your show. I like your interviews. Last night you had Bob Chapman. I really wanted to get through, but I couldn't make it. I work at a General Motors plant I've got over 30 years in, and I was thinking about retiring, but he has me scared because I'm not sure if they're going to have a retirement fund or a medical fund available.
Well, I'll tell you what, if nobody knows definitely what's going to happen, but you know, if China starts flooding cars into this country, they're going to wipe out General Motors and Ford, and they're going to have a real impact. And General Motors is not making hardly anything on their cars. They're making it off of their, financial investments and off the lending part of this. And I think that they could turn this thing around, but that they're going to have to take some pretty stringent steps. And the real problem is that they have, if the stock market goes down, there's going to be mass underfunding of their pension funds and of their health care promises. So, it'll be real nice if you can get what you've been promised, but don't count on it.
No,
make your
I
plans
don't.
As if you're not going to get it, and if you do get it, then consider it a bonus.
Okay. And I have one other comment I'd like to make to you real quick.
Go ahead.
I truly believe in my heart, after all these years of listening to you, that you are a closet Ronald Reagan supporter. I think you admire him. I know you find fault into him. But I truly believe if you take all the knowledge that you possess today and you go back to 1980, you vote Reagan over Carter. Or in 84, you vote Reagan over Mondale.
Oh, I always voted for Ronald Reagan. I believed in everything Ronald Reagan said. But the difficulty was he didn't always do what he said. That was the thing.
Oh, no. But he was almost assassinated, and I think that changed his, outlook.
You know, I would give almost anything to know what he really believed. I mean, I've pondered this question over and over again in my mind, and I've gone back and forth one side or the other, and the final analysis is, I don't know. I wish I did, but in the final analysis, it really doesn't matter what I think. We have the history of what happened during that time. Communism is not dead.
No,
we have bigger government than we ever had before. We have far greater debt than we ever had before. And it may be that Ronald Reagan was simply the victim of the people who surrounded him. Maybe that's what happened.
Yeah. The other comment I wanted to make to you was, do you believe God speaks us to us today, other than through the Bible? Do you think he sends messages through things?
Well, I don't know whether he sends messages through things, but I see his hand in so much of what I do. I will not go into a great deal of detail, but I've been praying for something that was just one of those things that could never happen.
Yeah.
And yet it has happened, and I've seen evidence of it. I believe God really does look after and interfere in the affairs of men and guides us to where he wants us to be.
I agree with you 100%, and I'm going to bring up Ronald Reagan to you again. On the final day of his funeral, the very last moment at the funeral in California, as the sun was setting and all the eulogy was done, as they moved the casket over to the final place, the sun set, and it felt like God said to me, the sun has set on the natural life of Ronald Reagan, so has the sun set on America.
Well, God bless you. Thanks so much for calling, Greg.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And this is Dr. Stan, and of course, if you'd like more information on fluoride, our telephone number, 1-888-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. We got a great program coming up this next hour. You won't want to miss it. We'll be back in just a moment with Dr. William Wagner talking about how Islam plans to change the world. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us Dr. William Wagner. We're going to be talking about his book, How Islam Plans to Change the World. Dr. Wagner, thank you so much for being with us again tonight. Dr. Wagner, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Thank you so much for being here. Dr. Wagner's been on our other two programs. But you can feel perfectly free to repeat what you've said before, because very, very few of our people have heard the earlier conversations. And besides that, I believe repetition is probably the best way of teaching anyway. Dr. Wagner has been a missionary for many, many years, has worked in the Muslim world, has had contacts with Muslims. And the average individual does not understand that, you know, for almost 1,000 years, while the Muslim faith was spread by the sword, and the Muslims, of course, had taken Spain and southern France. They were actually driven out of Western Europe in 1492, but they had advanced on Vienna, and it was in 1683 when the last great battle was fought, and the Muslims were turned back at Vienna. Otherwise, we'd all be speaking Arabic. But of course, you still see the Muslim faith all throughout the Balkans, that area of the world. And of course, for the last 300, maybe at least 300 years, why this Muslim drive to rule the world, which of course was what Allah had told Muhammad, and that has been sort of put on the back burner. But there are an increasing number of people today within the Muslim faith who have been recruited into this radical form of Islam dating back to the 6th century, and their goal is to control the world. So you pick up the story there, Dr. Wagner.
Right, I think you're absolutely right on that, Stan. In the Quran, it states very expressly that the day will come when the whole world will be Islamic. And that's what they were working on back, you know, about 500, 600, 700 years ago. And then they were sidetracked from the way you so aptly described it in France and in Austria. And then with the time of colonization, they were pretty well redundant and not doing a lot. Now what happened, in about 1920, with the rise of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, is when they began once again to say, we do have the opportunity of changing the world and making the world Islamic, and they have been working at it, particularly in about the last 20, 30 years, out of Mecca. They have been very serious about trying to change the world to Islam. In fact, from the Muslim World League, they make a statement and say, we will have a Muslim world by the year 2080.
Now, of course, you've actually talked to some Muslims, leaders of this movement, haven't you, or members of the movement?
Yes, I have,
And what have they told you?
Well, what they said, they've given me many different ways of how they're going to be able to achieve their goal. One of them said that the first state in the United States that's going to be Muslim will be Michigan. And I just returned from up there not too long ago, and about 50% of Detroit, Michigan is now Muslim. And I was told that 90% of Dearborn, Michigan, the home of Ford Motor Company, is Muslim.
Well, we've got a lot of listeners there in Detroit. Maybe they'll like to give us a call and let us know what's going on there in Detroit and Dearborn and surrounding areas. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, I guess, Dr. William Wagner, of course, is a missionary. He's with the Southern Baptist organization at the present time, but for many years, what was it, 30 years or so, you were a missionary?
Right, I was 32 years a missionary in Europe, Middle East, and North Africa with the Southern Baptists. I also spent about 12 years being the chairman of the Muslim Awareness Committee of the European Baptist Federation. So I was working quite extensively with Muslims that were living in Western Europe.
Well, of course, what is the attitude of the average Muslim towards the society of Western Europe, towards the society of the United States? Certainly, now from the point of view of women, why, they have freedom here that they would never have in a truly Muslim state with Sharia religion. And even for the average Muslim male, they have freedom and opportunity that would never befall them living in a truly theocratic society.
I think that's right. I think that, you know, many people have said to me, Bill, do you really believe that the average Muslim is a radical and wants to change the world by use of the sword? I'd probably say, no, I don't think so. I do think that the average Muslim, if you talk to them about whether or not they will make the world Islamic, they'll all say yes, because that's in the Quran, so they wouldn't debate that.
But then, of course, the Christian believes that we're going to have eventually Christ is going to rule the world. So the Christian has a similar belief, doesn't he?
Well, yeah, I think this is true. Of course, the Christian, if you really want to get into eschatology, you get into the point of saying we really believe that the world is, that actually Christianity is going to decrease in some of its influence before Christ comes back, but then supernaturally that the kingdom of Christ will be established, whereby the Muslims say that we will carry out the establishment of the kingdom of Islam.
And I think that is really such an important distinction, because we don't, as Christian believers, we don't think we're going to do that. We think that it's going to be done. It's going to be Jesus Christ. Would that be a fair differential?
You're absolutely right, Stan. Mm-hmm.
All right, fine, but of course the Muslim is caught up in this. I mean, this is his very essence, his being, his culture, is his religion, and certainly whether, of course, he's living in Southeast Asia and it comes from a Southeast Asian stock, or whether he's an Arab living in the Middle East. The Muslim faith is really an all-encompassing faith, isn't it? And, of course, it has very, very strict rules, and if you're going to be a good Muslim, you've got to abide by those.
Yes, that's absolutely true. In fact, I have an article that I received not too long ago from the London Times where it said that 16,000 white Anglo-Saxon English people had converted to Islam in the last 6 months.
Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest is Dr. Wagner, and we're talking about the Islamic influence in the world and the fact that many white Anglo-Saxon people in Europe are actually converting to the Muslim faith. We know that many blacks in our prisons and in the inner city are embracing the Muslim faith. So the Muslim faith's influence is growing in the Western world, isn't it?
Yes, it is growing, and I think it's growing from several reasons. Number one, they asked these 16,000 in England, why did they become Muslims? And they said, because they practice their faith. They believe their faith. And I think that is in contradiction to what we as Christians, in many cases, we say that we're Christians, but we don't really practice our faith. We're more involved in a secularistic form of life than we are trying to live the gospel that was presented to us by Jesus Christ.
And of course, if you compare the culture of the United States with the culture in the Muslim world, and certainly I abhor so much of what it involves, but they believe in, that sexual demonstrativeness is wicked, and yet we accept this sort of thing. They believe that homosexuality is wrong, and we accept this. And all you need to do is turn on television and see the depravity that's portrayed there, and the Muslim looks at that and says, America is a depraved nation. And I could see why they would believe that and why some people would want to embrace a faith that at least said that it had very, very specific rules as far as life and morality is concerned. Would that be a fair appraisal?
I think that's absolutely right. You know, Ayatollah Khomeini basically said that Islam is going to take over the world, and he gave five steps. He said the first step was going to be the defeat of the Shah in Iran, which they did. He said the second step was going to be making Islamic republics as they defined it out of Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon. Then he said the third step would be the driving Israel into the sea and having it cease to exist. The fourth step would be the changing of Western Europe. Then he said America would be the last that would convert to Islam. And he said the moral degradation would be so bad in this country that the American people would beg and plead for Islam to come in so that they would have some value system that they could live by. Sam?
Are you there? No, I didn't do anything. I was just sitting here. When did we go off the air? Well, we've lost. I was just sitting here and. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and let's see if, Andy, would you tell me if we're on the air again? We're on now. Well, would you get our guest back again, and we'll see. I don't know what happened there. I apologize, but we suddenly went off the air. But our fortunately, our engineer got us hooked up again, and we're in good shape. So hopefully we'll have Dr. Wagner back on. But we were simply talking about the fact that our society has really gone into tremendous spiritual and decline. And I believe, of course, it's because the church has not taken a strong stand to try to preserve the moral fabric which once made America the envy of the world. And, of course, as I pointed out, freedom is not the ability to do whatever you want to do. Freedom is the ability to do what you should do according to God's law. And Dr. Wagner, about that time, I think we got disconnected. Go ahead. Dr. Wagner, are you there?
Cut off.
Okay, fine. We got you back again.
Right, uh-huh.
All right, fine. Well, then tell us your impression. Now, when we talked before, you talked about the tremendous amount of money that is being spent to actually promote Muslim evangelism of the entire world. Would you like to pick up on that idea?
Yes, what they have is they have three different, really, we could say, pillars to try to convert the world. One of them is Dawah, which is missions. Another one is Jihad, which is holy war. And the third one is the building of mosques. And these mosques cost an enormous amount of money. And so a lot of people have said, where do the Muslims get this money? Also, they use it in immigration, in buying houses and businesses for their people. And they spend a lot of money. But I did some figuring one time, and this is what I came up with, that Saudi Arabia at this time is pumping about 10 million barrels of oil a day. Right now, it is being sold for about $52 a barrel. And I've been able to show that they are clearing about $40 a barrel, which means that the Muslims have about $400 million a day from their oil money that they are able to use. Now, of that, I can prove that they are giving at least one-fourth of their oil money for the furtherance of Islam, because, you know, in the Muslim countries, there's no separation between the church and the state, and so the state just funnels that money directly on into the furtherance of Islam. That means that Islam has about $100 million a day on which to use for their missionary work.
And, of course, aren't they spending an awful lot of it on mosques here in the United States and on missionary work in the prisons and in going into our communities and pushing and encouraging the Muslim faith?
Yes, absolutely. And that money that I've mentioned only comes from Saudi Arabia. Then there's also Kuwait and Oman and the Emirates and Brunei and Iran and some of the other ones. So I think that the amount of money that they have is just phenomenal. I used to work with the International Mission Board of the Southern Baptists, which is the world's largest mission society. And we have 6,000 full-time missionaries, 40,000 part-time missionaries, hospitals, schools all around the world. And our yearly budget is $300 million a year. So they get that in 3 days.
And, of course, they are certainly putting a tremendous emphasis on spreading the Muslim faith here in the United States, not only that, but keeping the Muslims who are already here very close to the mosques. And you had said on one of the previous programs that about 80% of the imams, that would be like the minister in the mosques in the United States, are from the radical Wahhabi sect, which is, of course, pushing this whole idea of the Muslims taking over the world. Would that be a fair statement?
Yes, that's a fair statement. The Muslim World League, the one that is really the mastermind for their missionary endeavor, is located in Mecca, and they're the ones that basically have the control of the money. And so what they do in places such as the United States, they do this also in Europe, but let's just stick with the United States, they will come in and they will say, we will help you build or buy your mosque, we will help pay your imam, if you will sign up to be a Wahhabi mosque. And the Wahhabism is your more radical form of the Sunni Muslim thought. And so when these mosques do become Wahhabi, they basically are radical. And there was a Senate hearing not too long ago where one of the more moderate imams made a statement and said 80% of all of the mosques in the United States today are Wahhabi mosques.
Well, how can we counter this influence? You know, certainly they are totally dedicated to their desire to take over the world. The average Christian in the United States, he just wants to live and be allowed to continue living and enjoying the good life. And maybe even enjoying some of the immoral things that are going on here, because of course so many Christians feel that once they're saved, they're always saved. They really have nothing to worry about. They're going to get to heaven. They got a free ticket. I suspect some of these people are going to be a little surprised down the line. But anyway, you know, what can we do to counter this influence? Not only here, but in Africa and in Europe, and throughout so much of the rest of the world, where the Muslim faith is growing and growing rapidly.
Well, really, it's, if you study who their enemies are, it used to be up until about 1990 that they quite freely would say that the greatest enemy of Islam is communism. And then when communism failed, they're saying now that the greatest enemy of Islam is Christianity and Christian missions. Now, occasionally I hear that the greatest enemy is secularism, because they have to fight secularism somewhat like we do too, particularly for some of the Muslims that come to the West. But they are very much concerned about Christianity. And I believe that we in the United States now are fighting this battle where there are forces that are saying, let us separate ourselves from our Judeo-Christian roots and let us no longer consider ourselves a Judeo-Christian society. And I think that if we're serious about this, we're going to have to return back to our roots.
In fact, if we don't have a revival in America, we're going to lose America. We, you know, if you believe that this is a spiritual battle, we've lost the spiritual battle because, of course, we're not addressing the spiritual foundation to everything that's going on. Would you agree that that a spiritual revival would be the major hope we would have here?
I'd say you're absolutely right. Now, one thing I discovered, though, is about 15 years ago, something began to dramatically change.
All right, you're going to tell us about that in just a moment here when we get back here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Dr. William Wagner. We're talking about his book, how Islam plans to change the world. And you were saying that something had changed about, what was it, 15 years or so ago?
Yes. Actually, what was happening prior to that time, there was a large number of Muslims that would leave Islam for various reasons, and then they would convert back to Islam. It was amazing. There was about, we estimate, maybe up to 80% that would leave Islam would go back to Islam.
Now, would they become Christians? Is that why they'd leave Islam, or what?
Well, they would leave Islam and become Christians, or sometimes they'd become Buddhist, or let's say atheist. But then 80% of them would go back into Islam. And one of the reasons why that happened was because we did not understand their culture, and they could not function or live in a Western culture. But about 15 years ago, suddenly that began to change quite radically. And many people are saying, no, I'm finding something in Christianity. I'm finding a new purpose and a new life. And also what's happening, Stan, is that a large number of those people that are saying, I want to be a Christian, I don't want to be a Muslim, are having dreams, visions, or hearing the voice of God speaking to them. And I've spoken to well over 300 Muslims who have left Islam and become Christians, and they all will recite the same thing to me. God appeared to me in a dream or a vision, and that's why they have become Christians.
Well, you know, I think that's really so interesting. I have heard similar stories. Now, God has never appeared to me in a dream or a vision. I sort of wish that he would, but he never has. But I have heard this story from Jews, and I've heard this similar story from other Muslims, certainly nowhere near as many as you have. But you're saying, you've heard this story from almost 300 of them?
Yes, And they're all very similar. I knew a man who was a sheikh from one of the North African countries, and he had gone down to Mecca and was on the Hajj, you know, and he had to walk around the Kaaba, that big black building in the middle of the square in Mecca. He had to walk around that 7 times, and as he was walking around it, he heard a voice say, Jesus Christ is the Lord. And he looked around and just saw a bunch of Muslims and didn't know what to think about that. He kept walking, and he heard that voice again. He became a Christian, and he claims today that it was the voice of God talking to him in Mecca.
Well, you know, the fact that there are supernatural things that are happening, and I think that this probably signifies that these are very important times in God's plan for the world. And he's actually reaching out for certain people that he's going to bring into the kingdom. Now, you and I don't have the ability to do that. I mean, you know, if these people have a supernatural experience, and this can certainly bring them into the kingdom. But what can we actually do to help people, you know, because certainly we don't have any supernatural power. All we have the ability of persuasion.
Well, there's another thing that they're very afraid of, and that is love. Islam is not a religion of love. Islam is really a religion of fear. I've known many, many Muslims. I count many of them as my friends. But they're always very, very fearful. They're fearful of their own religion. They're fearful of God. The Muslim God is not a God of love. He is a God to be feared. He's a God that has total dominion over their life, and he can change his mind. So love is something that they cannot always understand. And so I think that the most...
Hold that thought right there for just a moment, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this evening is Dr. William Wagner. We're talking about his book, How Islam Plans to Change the World. And Dr. Wagner was saying that, you know, starting about 15 years ago in his mission work, he encountered something very unusual. And that is that many Muslims were having supernatural experiences that were bringing them to become Christians. And they would either have a vision, or they'd have a dream, or God would actually, in physical form, speak to them. And this was, of course, what was taking them from the Muslim faith into the Christian faith, because you have to understand, if you were a Muslim living in a Muslim nation, and you convert to Christianity, why, they can kill you. You lose your friends, you lose your family, you lose your job. If you are a Muslim living in a Muslim world and you convert to Christianity, why this is the most dramatic and dangerous thing you can possibly do. And yet, of course, Muslims are still doing that, aren't they? Go ahead.
Yes, what it is, they have, you know, Sharia law. And their Sharia law goes back, I would say, you know, into the 7th century. It's a very, very brutal law. And in this Sharia law, they will commit all kinds of atrocities in the name of God. I was in one of the Islamic republics one time, and a missionary had his video recorder stolen from his house, and it was a 12-year-old boy that had gone in and taken the video recorder out, and the police caught him 2 days later. And the police came to the missionary and said, "You have a decision to make." And he said, "What is it?" He said, "We've caught this boy, and we either will cut off his right hand or send him to prison for 10 years, and you make the decision. What do you want to do?" And the missionary said, "Well, I'm not going to make that decision." And they said, "You don't understand. You will make the decision." He said, "I don't want to press charges. You will make the decision what's going to happen." So he sent him to jail for 10 years. But the Sharia law is very harsh, and Muslims that are living under it are very fearful of that.
And, of course, the other thing, I've talked to Muslims who tell me that they have a great fear of hell, that, you know, this is something that's very real to them, and that you are never, as a Muslim, sure that you're going to go to heaven. In other words, the only way you could really be sure of going to heaven would be to die in jihad, killing the enemy, but other than that, you're never really assured of salvation. Would that be a fair statement? Have you heard that?
Yeah, that's an absolutely fair statement. And, you know, we have what they call in the Christian world hellfire and damnation preachers who preach about hell. But they don't even begin to approach the description, the very graphic descriptions of hell that you have in the Quran and in the Hadith. The Hadith is also very bad about that. I read one where they said that when the person goes to hell, that, and there's a demon there, and he begins to peel away your skin about an inch at a time, slowly but surely, off of your body, until your whole body has had all of the skin peeled away with all the pain, and then you grow the skin back again. That happens 10,000 times. So when you begin to read about the description of hell, I can see where anybody would be tremendously fearful of going to hell. And particularly when there is no assurance of going to heaven except for the jihad, and also if a person dies on a pilgrimage, on a hajj, then they too go directly into heaven.
So that really gives you an incentive to want to go on that hajj. Anyway, of course, this is a very, very strange religion, and I think one of the really great misconceptions of the modern times, and certainly perpetuated by many people in the current administration, is we all worship the same God. I mean, the Muslims believe in Jesus Christ, and the Muslims worship the same God as the Christian. How would you respond to that?
Well, I would respond to it this way. There is what they call an Abrahamic ecumenicism, which says that because Abraham was the father of the Jews and of the Christians and of the Muslims, that through Abraham we're all worshiping the same God. Now, in the studies that I've made, and I've talked with many Muslims and Jews about this, I have found very few Muslims and very few Jews that will say they agree with that. They will say, no, the gods are totally different. The only ones that really believe that are the more moderate Christians. And I think they believe it because they want to be open to other faiths and other religions and everything. So they say it's the same God, but the Muslims come and say, no, no, you as Christians have three gods. And then they will not even consider the Jewish God, Jehovah, to be the same as Allah, that the Muslims just would totally reject that. So I think that the idea that we all are worshiping the same God is just completely, totally wrong.
In fact, on most of the flags of the Muslim nations, you'll see a crescent moon.
Right.
I mean, in one way or another, that crescent moon represents their God. They worship the moon God. And, of course, until you understand that this is an entirely different God, this, in my estimation, is a satanic God, you can't understand the basis of their religion.
This is right, absolutely right. Now,
just a moment, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. I guess this evening is Dr. William Wagner. Go right ahead, please.
Well, Stan, what you're absolutely right on this idea of the moon god. You see, when Muhammad began his ministry in Mecca, they had the Kaaba. They had this big black stone there in Mecca. And at that time, they worshipped 360 gods, one for every day of the year. Their calendar was different. And then the chief god was the god Sin, S-I-N. That's where they get this word Sinai, the Sinai Peninsula. It has nothing to do with our word Sin. But it is said that when Muhammad came in, what he did is he threw away 359 of the gods and just kept one of them, and that was the moon god. And so much of their religion has to do with the moon. As you say, their symbol of the moon, their Ramadan, which starts when they can first see the first sliver of the moon and ends when they can see the last sliver of the moon. Much of their religion has to do with the moon.
And I think that to the Christian who honestly believes that there is any similarity between their religion and ours, it simply shows the fact that people don't teach Christianity very well. And they actually, of course, believe that Jesus was a prophet, but he was not God at all, whereas the Christian belief is that this was God incarnate, come to earth to sacrifice himself for man's sin.
Absolutely. They had a poll that they took several years back in the Ivy League schools, and they asked these Ivy League students, you know, some of our brightest, best educated of our young people, this question: if Islam were to take over control of the United States, would this change your way that you live? And 73% of these American young people said, no, it would not change it. And they simply do not understand Islam, nor they understand Sharia, nor do they understand what would really happen. And so the main reason I wrote the book is that I just want people to understand what they say they're going to do, and what they say they will issue in, and what type of a life they want the people in the United States and the world to live. And again, most of what I've said is not what I'm saying, but what they're saying.
And when we get back from the break, I want you to tell, us what you've learned from talking to the Islamic people, to the Muslims, about, of course, what's going on today. I think that, of course, we're being totally misled as we focus on the external threat. I believe that much of the threat is right here within the Muslim community in the United States, and as they expand their families, as they expand their political control, as they work towards a Muslim America. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Of course, if you're looking and seeing what's happened in Europe, why, the European societies are dying out. France, the French society, has 1.4 children per family. Germany has about 1.4. Italy has 1.2 children per family. It takes 2.2 children to reproduce. Why the Western people are dying out in Europe. And the Muslims are moving in and reproducing with massive families. And isn't this part of their plan to take over simply, not by conquest, but simply by inserting themselves, their agents, into our society and then simply outpopulating us?
Well, they're doing this in many ways, and you're absolutely right when you mention the death of the West, the death of, I would say, the Western peoples. The United Nations made a statement that said by the year 2055, one half of all the young people under the age of 21 in the world will be Muslims. So this date of 2080 is not an unrealistic date. And so just simply by the birth rate alone, they could possibly take over the world. It wouldn't be by 2080, it'd be later than that. But they also have this Dawah, which is this mission. And this mission is a very highly organized, it's a very good strategy, and they are doing everything they can to bring people to Islam.
Could you explain what Dawah is for the listeners out there and the three pillars of their plan to take over our society?
Yeah, one of them is Dawah. And Dawah is the same as our word missions. And it's basically their attempt to convert people, to convert societies, to convert as many as they can to Islam. Now, they have a major strategy in place, and what's strange, I'm a Christian missiologist, and I say that we as Christians do not have nearly as good a strategy as the Muslims do. They use business, they use their economic strength, they use their students, they use almost everything that they have in an attempt to try to bring people from the other countries of the world into Islam. Now, they also have what is called a da'i, a D-A-A-I, and a da'i is a missionary. And there are more Muslim missionaries working in the United States today than there are American missionaries working in all the Muslim countries put together. It's the same way with Western Europe. And so they have a large number of people that are working for that singular goal of trying to bring people into Islam.
Now, are they paid missionaries? Or?
No, they're not paid. They're not paid. In some cases, some things are paid for them, such as some of the foreign students are given scholarships to come over here and to be a da'i in one of the universities. There is some financial remuneration, but they're not full-time, professional, paid missionaries like what we would have. I was in Morocco one time, and I was teaching a class of English of about 200 students in Fez, Morocco. And I made the statement, I said, now, you're learning English. Why are you learning English? One young man raised his hand and stood up and said, I am learning English so that I can help win the Western world to Islam. And I was somewhat taken back, and so I said, well, that's a very worthy reason. How many of you feel the same way? And 200 hands went up. Everybody would raise their hand. That's why they wanted to learn English. So they have a very effective missionary force working. They work in our schools, in the prisons. They're working with the Native Americans, the Indians in Gallup, New Mexico. They have a brand new large mosque on the main road, primarily for the desire to win Indians. They're working in a large number of our different parts of our society in America today.
And I don't think the average person has any idea. They're certainly working very effectively within our prisons, where if you convert to the Muslim faith, you get all sorts of special privileges. Why would our prisons give special privileges to one religious sect like the Muslims, where they would not give to you if you were a Christian and were to convert Christianity? And I would simply ask that as a question and hope that you might ponder on the answer to that.
Well, one thing you have to realize is that they are very subtle, and they are using very effectively the fact that they are outsiders, and they're using very effectively the idea that we need to be cross-cultural and we need to understand this new culture.
Of course, if we were over in their country, they wouldn't talk about cross-culture. They would not allow us, to proselytize. In fact, if you were to try to proselytize for Christianity in a Muslim nation, why, you would be punished or even executed.
Well, you can't have any type of a worship service in Saudi Arabia. You can't even have a Bible circle in Saudi Arabia. It's against the law. And if you do have it, they will kick you out of the country. Or if you're a Filipino or one of these other countries, they will put you into jail for doing it.
So they talk about tolerance, but they don't really practice tolerance at all. In fact, their religion is totally intolerant.
Yes, absolutely. You know, one of the things they have, and you brought this up earlier, and you were absolutely right, they have this idea of apostasy. And in apostasy, it basically says this, that if you convert from Islam to any other belief system, whether it be Christianity, Judaism, Hinduism, or whatever it is, then you are to die. This is under the Sharia law. Now, they're very generous, and they say, we will not kill you for 3 days. You have 3 days to change your mind. But after 3 days, then that's it. And it is really a rather brutal religion, and it goes back to the Sharia law that came out of the 700s, and they are not willing to change that. In fact, they had a large conference not too long ago where they said, will we change our concept of apostasy, where we will kill those that will leave? And there were some moderate Muslims that said, It's not up to us to punish people on this earth. If somebody leaves Islam, let's let God do the punishment. When they die, then they will go to hell, and not for us to punish them here on this earth. And they had, I was told, they had some very strong discussions about whether or not to do away with the concept of apostasy. And the final decision was no, they would not do away with it for two reasons. One was because the Quran taught it. And the other reason was because there was some fear that if suddenly they no longer had this apostasy rule, that there would be a mass exodus of people out of Islam, because people are staying in Islam because of fear.
What can we actually do to counter what's going on today?
Again, this idea of love, I think that what we have to do is we have to say, do we have anything to counter them? Do we have a belief system? Do we have any faith? And if we don't, then maybe it might be best for them just to go ahead and take over, you know, so they would be able to give this belief system. But I think the key to this, Sam, has to be a renewal within America. And I think that we have to refine or recreate our Christian heritage and understand what Christianity is and come back to the very basic teachings that our fathers had and once again become active in our churches. And I think that's going to be by far the best way to counter this move forward by Islam.
And yet I see within our churches today an increasing moving away from the traditional teaching of the church and into a more raucous music with the rock music there, and getting away from the old hymns into sort of the of hymns that make you feel sort of warm and fuzzy, but they really don't, of course, address the philosophical issues of Christianity. And, of course, the old idea of Bible teaching really seems to have gone in many respects by the wayside as we begin to, change our whole approach to biblical teaching, to not what the Bible says, but how do you feel about the Bible, or what do you think about this?
Well, I'm what I would call a conservative Christian. Most of us Southern Baptists are. And I agree wholeheartedly with you with what you're saying. But I think that we have an increasing number of people that don't go to church, an increasing number of people that don't read their Bible, that don't pray. And we have a society today that emphasizes comfort. We want to be comfortable. We want our own way. And because of this, we're beginning to lose our faith. And you've asked, how can we counter this Islamic move forward? We can counter it by becoming active and strong once again in our churches and being involved in the proclamation of Christ. One thing that happened, you know, when 9/11 took place, a lot of people said, boy, Islam's going to get a black eye because of this. But here in San Francisco, 2 days after 9/11 took place, in the paper and on many of these mosques, there were signs that said, come and learn about what Islam really teaches. And the next thing you know, that people were going to these mosques and saying, well, what does Islam teach? And they were saying, well, Islam is a religion of love, forgiveness, peace, happiness, joy. And they were using all of these Christian words to describe Islam, which are not Islamic words. And 6 months after 9/11, there was about 50,000 Americans that converted to Islam, because they were ready, and they were able to draw in those people whose lives had a vacuum as far as their belief system was concerned.
Well, I think that a lot of people have a vacuum in their life, and of course they want something to fill that, and that, of course, what Christianity traditionally did. But unfortunately, we have a very powerful competing force where, of course, you really see these people's lives change, and you can take the black out of the inner city who's a thug, and you can bring him into Islam, and his whole life changes. His name changes. He wears a suit. He gives up drugs. He begins to police the neighborhood. He provides people with safety. He does what the local authorities can't do, and suddenly they have a... this would attract many people, because people are looking for order in their lives. They don't want to live in a society where there just are no rules and no punishments. They recognize there's something seriously wrong in America. And, of course, at least the Muslims, whether it's a real answer or not, at least they have an answer.
That's true. Well, I'm saying that we as a church need to create a new pietism. And some of my students say now, Dr. Wagner, do we really want a pietism? I'm saying, I'm not sure that it is pietism that we need, but we need to have very simply a biblical set of rules, a biblical way of living, and to return back to that, which I think they have in the New Testament church. And if we did do that, I think we would see that we would win the battle. We have the spiritual strength to overcome Islam, and I think that we will do it through the faith that we do have.
Well, of course, traditionally, they, of course, would spread their religion by the sword. Now they're doing it by a much more effective means, I think, and simply that is by outpopulating us, and then, of course, with their mosques here, and with the order that you see in the Muslim life, they're giving people something that they're not seeing in society as a whole. So I agree with you, but how are we going to get Christianity to become effective in competition? Because if you're going to defeat an idea, you have to defeat it with a better idea.
Of course, that's what I've kind of given my whole life to try to help young people and others to become more dedicated to the Lord. And I think that we're having a lot of success on that. You did mention the mosque. I wanted to kind of bring that out, too, to show you again some of the things that they're doing. They are building mosques all over the world. I just got back from Indonesia and Thailand, and there's big, beautiful mosques. I just got back from Dearborn. They got a big, beautiful mosque up there, and they built one not too long ago in Rome, about one-fourth the size of St. Peter's. And they're building these mosques everywhere because they're saying, this is our presence. This is going to show that we are growing by our mosques. And what they do many times, they'll go into a place and say, we just want to build one mosque. You don't have anything against that. And they'll say, no problem. Go ahead and build it. And then there's another and another and another. I think of before I had mentioned to you that they said that they wanted to win Western Europe to Islam. But they said that before they could win Western Europe to Islam, they had to win England. And before they could win England, they had to win London. And in 1982, there was one mosque, or 1962, there was one mosque in London. Now, there are 644 mosques in London. But what they're doing is they are building mosques, and then they're also destroying church buildings. And whenever you see that there is any conflict between Muslims and Christians, you will also read in the same article that five churches were burned down or three churches were bombed, and they destroy the churches, but at the same time, they build the mosques.
Well, certainly I know in Nigeria, back, in fact, it was on September 11, 2001, the very day of the attack on the World Trade Center. The Muslims were armed in Nigeria, and they moved into the Christian area, and they started burning churches, and they started killing Christians because they knew something big was going to happen. Our FBI had no idea what was going to happen, but the Muslims in Nigeria knew there was going to be a major attack that day, and they were prepared, and they moved in, and they started to slaughter the Christians. And, you know, and as you say, they started burning the churches in the Christian areas of the towns where there was both a Muslim and a Christian component. So, but that's, of course, a story that was never told over here.
Well, another thing they do, another story that's not told, is they do everything they can to destroy churches in the Muslim countries. I had the opportunity of preaching a revival in the First Baptist Church of Cairo, Egypt, and it was a nice, large building, sat about 400 people in the city of Cairo, and the church was built in about 1935. When I preached, the walls were stained and discolored, the carpet was totally worn out, the benches had holes in the seats, the doors were falling off their hinges, there were small holes in the glass in the windows. And so I told the minister, I said, let me bring over about 50 young people and some craftsmen to come from Europe and also from America. And we will completely renovate your church building for free. You won't have to pay anything. And we would like to do this for you. And he said, you can't do that. And I said, oh, yes, I can. I can get the people. He said, no, no. It's against the law. in Egypt, you cannot repair a church in any way except to have the written permission of the president of the country, which you don't get. They could not paint the wall. They could not fix the carpet. They could not do anything. They want the churches to deteriorate alongside the new mosques that are being built. And the deterioration of the churches shows that Christianity is going down, and the building of the mosque shows that Islam is increasing.
Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment to wrap up this program this evening on how Islam plans to change the world. Where can people get your book?
They can get it through Amazon.com. All of your bookstores can order it, and quite a few of the bookstores and quite a few of the Christian bookstores do have it in stock.
And of course, that's Dr. William Wagner, his book, How Islam Plans to Change the World. We'll be right back here in a moment to wrap up this evening's program. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Dr. Wagner, we've got 3 minutes for you to wrap up this evening's program.
Well, Stan, I think that if I had one thing to say, it would be this, that we in the United States have to wake up to the danger that we have of the growth of Islam and the challenge that they're presenting before us of changing the world to become an Islamic world. I'm more afraid of state-sponsored religion than I am of state-sponsored terrorism. And I think that the terrorism, in one small way, is a smokescreen as to what they're doing. And people say, if we can stop the terrorism, then that's going to be the end of our problem. I don't think that's true at all. I think that our problem is going to be the growth, continued growth, of Islam in the world and their desires to take over the world. What's the answer? The answer is that we, who are Christians, once again evaluate who we are, evaluate what we have, and evaluate how we can best counter this threat. And if we really wake up to see that there is a threat, I think we will wake up to our responsibilities to Jesus Christ.
Well, I agree with you totally. I think that if the Christians will not be involved, if the Christians will not work to try to bring about a great revival in this country, we're going to lose America. It's quite just that simple. We have an enemy. The enemy is not outside the gates. The enemy is inside the gates. The enemy has a game plan. The enemy has unlimited funds. Of course, we can thank our government for making us dependent upon Arab oil so that they will have the money to carry out these programs, to proselytize for their religion in our society. These people will have one set of rules here in America. They have another set of rules in Islamic countries. In Islamic countries, there is no toleration. Here, they demand toleration, and which just feels so terribly deprived if they're not allowed to proselytize as they want. And yet, if you were to do this sort of thing as a Christian in Saudi Arabia or any of the other Muslim countries, why, you'd be severely punished, you'd be exiled, or you'd be killed. This is the way that the real world runs. So we're going to have to stand up for our faith sooner or later. I hope it'll be sooner. Do you have a parting thought for our listeners?
No, I agree wholeheartedly with you, Stan. I'm so glad that you got your radio program. And I hope and pray that people will listen very intently, listen to what you have to say to them, and will really wake up to the dangers that we have facing us today.
Well, good night, and God bless you, sir. And our guest has been Dr. William Wagner. He teaches up there in San Francisco at the Theological Institute, How Islam Plans to Change the World. Good night.
Good night. God bless.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Let me just mention that we do carry some material, some very good material on the Islamic faith. We carry a book called The Prophet of Doom. It's Craig Wynn's book. It's 1,000 pages, but you only have to read a couple of pages. He has several hundred pages of a glossary. And you want to know about Satanism and of course, the satanic or demonic influence in the church. He's got all the references from their writings. You can read the whole book and you'll know more about the Muslim faith than most Muslims will, or you can use it certainly as just a way to know where in their writing. They admit that Muhammad actually feared that he was demonically possessed. That's why they put out a contract on Salman Rushdie, because he talked about the satanic verse within the Quran. So you need to understand the Quran. Now, if you don't want to, of course, read the full book, we have 4 one-hour interviews with Craig Wynn. We think it's an excellent, excellent approach. We hope that you'll want to get four-tape set. It's called Islam, the Religion of Doom. The book is Prophet of Doom. So we carry this material. We'll give you tremendous insight into the Islamic faith and help to begin preparing you for the difficult times that lie ahead. And then, of course, we hope maybe you'll want to go to our website, radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com, and you can get all sorts of ideas there. We carry many, many books. We carry a number of four-tape sets. We carry a number of videos. Each one of them, of course, is designed to give you some additional idea of the true nature of this spiritual battle. And believe me, the background of the Islamic faith, of course, comes from the occult. So we hope that maybe we'll also want to actually consider getting a video we carry called The New Barbarians. That's The New Barbarians. It's by Carol Matriciana. And this is film footage that is taken off of Arabic television as they're indoctrinating the people in hatred of the West. And the little kids, they're 6 or 7 years old, being trained to become suicide bombers. We carry his fanatic Islam, A Global Threat by Victor Mordecai, and The Islamic Invasion, Confronting the World's Fastest Growing Religion, and that's also by Dr. Robert Morey. These books are available by calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to get the free newsletter put out by Radio Liberty, I think our last November newsletter on the fluoride, how fluoride is being used to create cancers in our society, to decrease fertility, to lower intelligence, to poison the endocrine system, to suppress thyroid function, to destroy the bony structure of our society. All these come based upon scientific studies. Maybe some of you would like to either get, well, my November newsletter is my evaluation of the fluoride problem. My December newsletter is the testimony that Dr. William Hersey, who is a scientist who worked for the EPA, his testimony before the Senate in the year 2000, totally blacked out by the controlled media, because the last thing they want you to know is that they're poisoning your children. So, again, we'll be glad to send you either the November or the December 2004 newsletter. Just give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, we hope many of you want to get my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, which goes into the background of the secret societies. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, there really are secret societies. We have another excellent book. It's called Fire in the Minds of Men. It's written by William James Billington. It's called Fire in the Minds of Men by James Billington, the Librarian of Congress. Give you insight into the secret societies. He writes about secret societies. And then Pray for America. Pray for revival, but please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. And so until tomorrow evening at the same time, we'll be back with you once again. Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.